at the time, and left the church. I think we decided it was 72 or 3. You retired and went to work with the farm workers completely. But Marion and Jim came down to look at the house and decided that it was appropriate because it was 20 minutes over the grade to Salinas. But it was also then a very tucked away house like this one is. It had, it was at the, you know, cul-de-sac at the dead end of the street and had a long driveway in to the house, which we called the tree house because you could hardly see it from the entrance anyway. It was hidden in the trees. A house kind of cantilevered out. Mm-hmm. And we had no idea how many would be with Caesar living there. And I think that we tried to count them at one time, and it might have been, you know, 12 or 15. And all, one bathroom,
plus,
which was...
plus the two dogs, I suppose.
Which, yeah, right. And so it was an open house in that it had just sliding screen shoji doors to block two bedrooms off. And the bathroom was really the only private place where you could go in and close the door. Otherwise, it was just a very open with a central fireplace. Mm. Caesar loved it. He loved being there. You know, it was a beautiful place to be in, rustic and not a really substantial house, but very adequate. We owned it for years. But at one point, we went down and had the telephone company come out and put a longer cord on the telephone so that they could take the telephone into the bathroom and have a private conversation, because this was the only place they could get to. And we used to go down about once a week from San Francisco, where Howard was minister in the Unitarian Church there. And we'd go down. We'd simply call the union office and say we're coming down, you know, and let them know. And we just come down and water and be in some evidence around there. And I found one interesting item that I noted, particularly being a woman, I guess, and that was that the same laundry was always drying on the... on the line. And I decided, well, you know, this was to make it look like it was really being lived in a normal way. But that laundry was always there.
It appeared to not have been taken down.
There were generally a couple of people there, a couple of men there all the time, mm-hmm. You know.
Well, a neighbor called and said, do you realize it's called San Francisco? Do you realize that where it should come? That was that thing on the south of the town of Lax.
Well, yeah, we had used that house, you know, as a second home, and we had allowed friends to use it from time to time, and rented it from time to time for a week or two, mm-hmm. or something like that. You know, a prominent national figure had his honeymoon there one time, but we'd had blacks there, mm-hmm. black friends, you know, and there had been no ruckus about it, but this person, this neighbor called and said, do you realize there's Chicanas? I said, yes. And he said, but, you know, that there are a lot of them driving in now the driveway fast. And I said, well, they shouldn't drive that fast, really. I know that. I'll speak to them. And I said, they're friends of ours. And he didn't really know, but he was concerned that we had Chicana.
Well, that's really interesting.
In this area, you know.
You were pastor at what was the name of the church?
First Unitarian Church.
First Unitarian in San Francisco.
It's the state church of San Francisco.
Until mm-hmm. what year? Through what year?
Yeah, we decided it was 1972, I think. 1972, and the Sunday of his retirement, which was in January, nearest his 65th birthday. And he was retiring from that job because there was a bylaw provision that said any minister had to leave when they reached 65, because they had one that had stayed too long. Mm-hmm. So the Sunday that he preached his last sermon, and they had the retirement ceremony. Richard Chavez was there in the service with him to welcome him into the migrant ministry then. And Dolores was there, just present, just joining with us. But Richard was in the program with him. And he had at that time worked out with Chris Hartmeyer what he might be able to do in the way of church support for the farm workers. Well,
and that was something I wanted to ask you about, because I can remember talking with you when you were laying your plans for establishing a migrant ministry within the denomination.
You have the machine on.
Yeah, it's on. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to know about that.
We were thinking about how we first got exposed to doing the migrant ministry, and we had, as the church, been helping the farm workers. And
congregation,
yes,
you're talking about.
Yes. Howard was working closely with the Social Concerns Committee, mm-hmm. which had projects, and we were helping the Alcatraz Indians and some blacks in their empowerment movement, and we had help for the farm workers, and we did fundraising and gathering of supplies and clothes and food and things for them, and also then recruiting volunteers for the striking and picketing and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I had gone, I'm not sure why Howard hadn't, maybe had gone to a church meeting or something, but I had gone to hear Chris Hartmeyer speak somewhere, maybe Walnut Creek or someplace nearby, where I went to hear him talk about the farm workers, and really became so impressed with him.
Was that still in the 60s?
And that was the late 60s. And I talked to him afterwards, introduced myself to him, and told him that retirement was coming not too far off, and that...
Interruption, you thought he was a committed person because he was holding his trousers up with a safety pin.
No, it wasn't a safety pin. No, but he just... he wore a very frayed jacket. No, I was impressed with his enthusiasm, his commitment, and everything which shone through, you know. And so I talked to him about what Howard might do. So we sort of kept in touch, and he was coming through the San Francisco airport one time and called, and we just made a date to go down and have lunch with him at the airport and talk to him. And that's where we began to formulate what might possibly be done with the Unitarian Universalist denomination. You see, the Unitarian Universalists are not part of the National Council of Churches, and so often we get left out of some of the movements that are going on. And we were not in the National Farm Worker Ministry because of that. Mm-hmm. So it was worked out that it would be a related relationship, just like we have with the National Council of Churches. It was a sort of an associate membership or something like that.
Well, you must have, the denomination must have joined right after the National Farm Worker Ministry was formed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Down at the meeting, I believe, where it was formed in Florida at the time of the famous controversy with the black boys and not allowed to go to Florida.
Oh, of course, I remember that meeting. That must have been the first time I met you. Yeah, in Central Florida. Yeah.
And,
Avon Park.
Previous to
what a memory you have.
Well, yeah, Avon Park.
Previous to that, I had kind of contacted our denomination fellowship and committee. Secure a thumbnail by a person to be a full ministry without salary, but complete ministry as minister for migrant farm workers of our denomination.
That was just before the Avon Park meeting.
Yes, United States and Canada, I see, was represented.
Okay.
And the board of our church was empowered by one of our smaller churches who inherited quite a bit of money. and David Grant on racial justice. The foundation, the board committed itself to, at that time, I think $12,000 a year to the new military and universalist migrant ministry to help with the expenses. And out of that $12,000, the board of the new migrant ministry, which was founded with representation from the East and the West and so forth, and was expanded a little later to include people like Margaret Pipes and Ernest Howard and others. But the board voted that $2,000 would be committed to the National Farm Worker Ministry, which was considered by the National Farm Worker Ministry as denominational dues, even though it was a labor organization. So we gave $2,000 each year officially. From the National Farm Worker Ministry point of view, it was dues. From the board of the Unitarian Association, the Universalist Association, it was a grant.
Interesting. Why couldn't the board see that as dues?
The National Farm Worker Ministry was a related organization of the National Council of Churches. And the Unitarian Universalists are not members of the National Council of Churches at that time, anyway.
But there were other groups that joined that were not members of the NCC.
Okay. I don't know as a fact that the board did not consider that as dues. Mm-hmm. That was my comment. I'm not positive on that.
Okay. So there was the agreement by the board of the church to have a denominational migrant ministry. And it would be staffed by you, but it was an unsalaried position at that time.
Right. But it was completely, as though I were a minister of the church. It was not a volunteer association.
Yes.
I was an official minister. This came up once, several times, and I would have to always go back to what's known as the fellowshipping committee to get the correspondence to indicate that I was a full-time minister.
Well, yes. It came up with the IRS one time. Income tax matters, and he had to have proof that he indeed was an official minister of the denomination.
So I assume you had continuing benefits and that type of thing, even though there was not salary.
No, the benefits, unfortunately,
no,
didn't go along
was,
with it.
It was fundraising that he was doing for UFW, and that's where it got involved.
I was doing fundraising for the Unitarian Universalist Migrant Ministry, who gave grants to various important projects by the vote of the board. One of the surprise grants, so Tony Orendine at that time, was having a radio program, you may recall, broadcasting into Mexico, urging braceros not to come over and break strikes. They ran out of funds. One day, Tony received a phone call from me asking whether he would like a grant of $1,000 to continue that project. Sort of thing we did.
Well, the clinic, the medical clinics, you know, we work closely with Marion Lewis about with medicine.
So the grants probably were channeled through
the migrant ministry.
Through the migrant ministry? Oh, no, yeah. No, I don't mean, to, I mean, from the denomination, were the grants channeled through the national, the national, Farm Workers Service Committee?
No, the grants were a grant from the Unitarian Universalist Migrant Ministry.
And direct.
Direct to the farm workers.
Like a Filipino village, the Agabiani village?
Yeah, that grant was $500 for helping on the furniture.
Mm-hmm.
There was a grant to then Eliseo Medina in Florida. And there was also a grant to the Arizona campaign when Caesar was in his fast there. But they were grants from the migrant ministry, but the funds, the source of the funds, was a blanket grant to the migrant ministry from a committee of the board, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated.
And lots of contributions.
Oh, well, there were contributions, yes. This was just the denominational official. The denomination officially was related on two levels, nationally and in our local district. I was
was also a minister for migrant farm workers at the Pacific Central District of the Ontario Agricultural Association.
And that would include the Central Valley?
Yeah, that really included all the direct activity that was going on here with the strikes.
That would not include the Central Valley, but this was included from San Luis Obispo up to Arcata on the coast.
Yeah, except that you...
Oh, along the coast.
Except that you took people down there to Coachella.
Because I know a lot of the denominations, their Northern California conferences included the Central Valley. But yours included only Central Valley in terms of the coast. Mm-hmm. I mean, Central part in terms of the coast. Okay.
It included, what is Central Valley? What's the name of one of the important towns? You mean Bakersfield?
Yeah, Fresno.
I included Central Valley. Fresno was in it. Bakersfield was in it. Sacramento was in it.
Oh, okay.
I take it back. Yeah.
Okay.
With the coast, but also into the valley.
Yeah. Has the denomination continued a migrant ministry?
It has. That's a very difficult question to answer because it's not on the same level.
No, we're near the same level.
When I retired, Ernest Howard was the new migrant minister in addition to his parish in Claremont, Mount Calaveras. When Ernie retired, which he did to Texas, partly for health reasons, one day Fred Eichter came with a minister who was then minister in San Jose to get my advice as to how this minister could apply for migrant ministry status under the denomination. And I gave him my advice. I understand, his name was Robert Lehman. I understand he organized a visiting Unitarian Universalist group to La Paz for one of those weekend briefings.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not kept in touch to see how it's going, but I know it's not on the same level, it's on a more modest level.
He's no longer in the San Jose Church, but he's still carrying on like a minister.
Robert Lehman.
Uh-huh. And he's really been working with Fred Eichter more directly.
Yeah.
You know, I think I am going to need to close this.
Yeah, just pull it.
I wanted to know why you felt that it was important to form a migrant ministry within the denomination, because I was thinking back about the other denominations and I don't think any of them had anything comparable. So it was like a new thing that you were suggesting. Why did you think that was important?
The recommendation of a man named Chris Hartmeyer, who was just a consultant from outside the denomination.
Well, I think I also know a reason, and that is that in the National Council of Churches, there's a pattern of the churches working together on many issues.
In sort of a coalition. And the Unitarians have never been involved in that. And so that something usually has to be set up quite separate when it comes to the Unitarian Universalist group.
I think in mind the Jewish community and its so-called Jewish desk as it related to the National Framework of Ministry. We began as kind of the Unitarian Universalist desk related to the Framework of Ministry, but increasingly got involved in the work of the National Framework of Ministry. So I eventually required a time to be the vice president of the National
Framework of Ministry. You had a good relationship, obviously, with Chris.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in some of your reflections about Chris and what some of the factors were about him and about the way the farmworker ministry operated that you found facilitating and attractive.
Chris was involved, I think, in the same orientation. I found that as I was without salary, I was impressed that Caesar and others would get $10 a week. Which
you felt five to begin with.
Camaraderie.
Yeah, it's not a camaraderie.
Five to begin with, and then 10.
And I did feel like Chris's work, for that matter, with the National Farm Worker Ministry was not in the typical trade union orientation, which I'm a supporter generally of trade unionism, but it had a kind of a commitment religiously that appealed to me very much in terms of the personal lifestyle of the people. They didn't return to a house like this, for instance. They returned to a more modest one.
So, and your own, obviously your own experience, just as you're reflecting on it, you didn't experience much separation between Chris and the farm worker ministry and Caesar and the union. You saw it as a kind of integral
yeah.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very interesting. You're the first person that has actually picked up on that.
Mm-hmm. One of the accommodations that the Unitarians needed to make, and I would try to indicate this to visiting Unitarians, that the religious orientation at the worship services at La Paz or the National Farm Worker Ministry was not typical of the Unitarian Universalist worship services. So a certain understanding of the commonality of our movements, despite the philosophical differences theologically in many cases, and the language and the ritual, was something that one had to be positive about and not negative.
So what kinds of things would have been
communion hard? Service, which is not typical. Ever since Ralph Waldo Emerson walked out of his church and way back when because of that. But you can certainly see where the fellowship concept is in the communion service. Though you might theologically, especially on the Christological basis, it would be like a Jewish rabbi would participate in communion service, but he was participating on the brotherhood, sisterhood level, rather than on the necessarily complete theological level.
Yeah.
And that was enough to be a serious participant and drink the body and blood of Christ, for instance, in the communion. Was always passed around at the conclusion of the National Farm Worker Ministry meeting. The last National Farm Worker Ministry meeting I attended before retirement was in Texas. It was in Florida. I've forgotten. But a young minister who was the new head of our Social Concerns Committee was invited to participate by me and did. His name was William Schultz. He's now the youngest president of the Unitarian Universalist denomination. At age 35,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that wasn't so very long ago. He was a very young minister.
He was always very supportive
yeah.
of the hard work.
He came down to check out the National Farm Worker Ministry meeting to see whether Ernest Howard made sense to have Ernie become my successor. The Unitarian Universalist denomination is. It's a much looser structure than most denominations, so it's...
Well, from what I know of the denomination, there would, of course, be a lot of support for a justice movement of this kind. But I assume that there also were those who, in the denomination who opposed the involvement of the denomination. Was that...
Curiously enough, very few. The most prominent example was the Unitarian from the East, who was a member of one of our most affluent churches, who was the Eastern Vice President of the Gallo Company, who came all the way out to Berkeley, we were living then, to meet me. And he was trying to persuade me that the support of the Gallo strike was really an error on our part. He impressed me very much by running a taxi for an hour and a half outside my house. George Frank then became the leading advocate within the denomination of the Gallo Company. And at one of our general assemblies, called, I've forgotten just where now, under some name.
It was New York.
New York.
Mm-hmm.
He debated Dolores Huerta on a resolution.
Poor fellow.
He did very well.
I have some pictures
of
that.
He really was clever, and he had he made a very major impression in the middle class Unitarian group that assembled. About 300 came to that particular meeting. But then the issue was debated on the floor of the convention as a resolution I had introduced. And we both had a kind of a victory. His main concern was to have the word gallo taken out of the resolution. And he succeeded. I debated him on the floor of the assembly. But the resolution that passed is, it's historically in the books, and I would have it here somewhere, is really a funny resolution, because in the back and forth of amending resolutions, they came out with this amazing statement that the Unitarian Universalist Association members were all urged to only drink that wine recommended by the Unitarian Universalist migrant minister, me. Said nothing about the boycott, you know, but I had great fun with it, because I could recommend any wine that I wanted to and suggest this is the wine you should drink. Even Calvin didn't have that. It's an official resolution. It's in the list of resolutions.
Oh, that's marvelous. Yeah. How clever.
I did not recommend Gallo.
I can imagine you didn't. Yeah. So that would have been in, was it, do you remember when that was? Was that 73?
It was before the final vote on the Gallo strike, about a year or two before.
We should also tell you that part of the migrant ministry meant that Howard was programmed at our yearly general assembly. And he had two things always going. We always had a table of a lot of material and literature and posters and buttons and all those things to advertise what was happening. And then he had a program each time. And we started out with
Tony Orendine.
Tony Orendine as the key speaker at the program.
Tony's fee was $1,000 from the Migrant Ministry.
Yeah, and this was one way to with the speaker's fee, you know, to transmit some of the funds to. But he'd had Richard one time. I think Richard was
in
the
New York
one. Yeah. And he'd had Dolores at one time. He had Jessica Gobea.
I had Dolores with debating Frank.
Yeah. And who was that delightful Filipino?
Philip Veracruz.
Yeah.
He was a great success. He sort of represented a kind of a new voice, and he had a wonderful time.
Oh, yeah.
I'll bet.
He stayed
but
on
there was
a couple
always
of days.
A major program on the farmer.
It's an annual
continental meeting of the United States and Canada.
And what is it called exactly?
Unitarian Universalist General Assembly.
At the time that Philip spoke to ours, what place was it? Cincinnati? I forget. Okay. It was the Congregationalists were having their General Assembly.
That was up in Canada in
it was Toronto.
Toronto, yeah.
We're having their General Assembly. And a gentleman named John Moyer contacted me and asked if he could borrow Philip Veracruz to speak at one of their meetings, which I...
Okay. Well, you must have...
But may I say one thing, though? The most important about meetings, the speaker was Cesar Chavez. Tremendous attendance.
That was the one that was held in Claremont.
In Claremont, and there's the largest... Mills College is there, Claremont College. It's the largest attendance we ever had at a migrant ministry program. The other part of the program...
We had a dinner for him at the local church for
the top brass.
The top brass and the big supporters of the migrant ministry. And
that was very successful.
100 or so.
That was at Ernie Howard's church.
Yeah.
And the time that Cesar spoke, the other part of the program was simply fascinating. It was the Teatro Campesino who put on Mama Vera. For which I think the migrant ministry contributed $500 to the...
Wow.
And Cesar stayed on for the Teatro. He hadn't intended to, but he was so fascinated.
Well, that
do you know about when that was, approximately?
Too bad I haven't been shape to look up records, but my yearbook, halfway through, let's say, approximately, that would be 5 years after, 6 years after we began.
Were you still pastor of the church in San Francisco?
This is when I'm Unitarian Universalist Migrant Minister. When I was pastor of the church in San Francisco, we had our local programs, but there was not this national scope.
So it was in, like, the mid-70s?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of our most effective speakers at that time, who I gather now was not connected, was Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
She had
I talked to her pretty often. She's in LA. She's doing organizing. Do you remember Bruce Hansen?
Sure.
Okay, she's working for Bruce Hansen's organization there in Washington. I mean, she's working in LA for that Washington-based organization and doing organizing in the Hispanic community in LA. And I don't know too much about it yet. It's a new job. But she was looking for some organizing in LA, and I put her in touch with Bruce, and that worked out. Of course, he snapped her right up.
Did Marshall go there too?
They have split up.
They have?
They have, yeah.
Hmm.
Collections from both of you. As you think back over your years of greatest involvement with the farm workers, if there were any particular experiences that stand out in your memory?
Sure. One of the great... You want to go for it?
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. I'm supposed to be way back.
Well, since it's over by you, why don't you start?
Okay. I've forgotten the name of the... ranch now, or the what do you call it, the ranch, but it was a large supplier of grapes to Gallo, and they were not allowing farm workers, union organizers to get into the ranch to talk to some of the farm workers who were isolated in the ranch about the union, about the national, I guess about the then their rights under the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, which had then been established. So there was a civil disobedience protest involving Fred Eister, myself, and a Catholic nun who is not familiar to me, but she was a very lovely person.
And where was this?
This was near Modesto, about 15 miles outside of Modesto. So we, in our clerical garb, tried to enter the ranch and were denied access by the owner. So we waited till the afternoon and we engaged in civil disobedience and in a car driven by a farm worker followed a truck in and went to this place where these farm workers were housed. And we were suddenly surrounded by the citizen's arrest of the owner or the manager, whoever it was, and a circle of cars, some police cars. And we were taken in two paddy wagons to the Modesto jail. I've forgotten, I think Fred was in one, and the nun and I were in another. It's one of these barred things. We got to the Modesto jail, and they wanted to let us out on
your own
reconnaissance. We refused. And there was quite a long time there, and finally, let me go back.
Wait just a minute to explain things over.
In the police car going through the 15-mile drive, the officer driving the car, who had frisked us before we got in, had long hair. fairly long hair, which is unusual in those days. And I spoke to the bar and I said, isn't it a little unusual to have, you know, hair like you've got and as a police officer? He said, yeah, I guess it is. But he said, you know, I went on a war in Modesto and became, got a 6 months visit to the police system, studied police systems in England. And we engaged in conversation, and it turned out that the Unitarian minister then in Modesto was a special enthusiast for what, worms, you know. What kind of worms are these, Rosemary?
Earthworms,
because it was an environmental, he was in the business. And I told the police officer this, and he was astounded because that was his great hobby. He was planning to retire and raise earthworms. So we discussed this at length, and I told him about, who was the minister then, Rosemary? He used to be in...
Bill Pearson?
No, he used to be in San Mateo.
Bill Peterson.
Yeah, Bill Peterson was minister then. I can even remember the address. And I gave this police officer the address and said to him, why don't you check it out and compare notes, because this fellow is quite an authority on earthworms. He said, I certainly will do that. Anyway, finally, sometime later, when the head detective came from the Modesto district and made the decision that we would go without our reconnaissance, he gave us a slip saying that we were not under arrest, but we were under, I don't know, interrogation, I guess. The farm workers said we were under arrest, having been frisked in the police car and all the rest of it. So it was one of those gray areas as to whether we were arrested or not. But in the middle of the interrogation with the detective, this police officer suddenly came in and said, excuse me a moment, what was the name, the address of that minister that you know? And I gave him the address. And suddenly we both were aware of the unusual circumstances with the astonished look of the head of the detective bureau. And he said, well, thank you, and excused himself and left. And that was kind of memorable. But the most memorable part of that was this police officer did contact Bill Peterson later. And Bill told me that he said it was the most difficult arrest I ever made of the non-minister. But more important than that was, the day after this happened, the policy of the ranch changed, and they allowed the farm workers to come in, the first one, and to discuss the National Labor Relations Board rights. It was the first ranch to vote for the UFW under the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, and it was the first ranch to be approved by the Agricultural Labor Relations Board. So it was a very happy outcome.
So that would have been 75 or 76, something like that.
Yeah. I was involved as an observer, I guess you say, as a clergyman in the gallows strike. And the person who was most helpful to me was Frank Ortiz, who was in charge of the gallows strike.
So that was another
time
important
later.
Experience for you, as an observer at the gallows.
I guess he called him an observer.
Did you have experiences for your
Well, I was working all the time while Howard was doing his volunteer work. I had the salary of the family, so that I was kept quite busy and was just felt like I was being supportive of everything he was doing and trying to help him with the, you know, organizational aspect of the migrant ministry, the mailings and the fundraising and things like that. I have quite a bit to do on that level. I can say that I just have a couple personal encounters that were kind of memorable. Caesar was coming up to speak in Berkeley somewhere or in Oakland at one time, and they had been staying at churches, and I think even sleeping over in churches when they traveled around to speak and something like that. And but anyway, I remember how we got into it. But Caesar was coming for dinner, so the
talk to a group of 60 people.
Yeah.
That's right. We had a group of 60 possible supporters coming that night. But he was going to come early for dinner. So whoever was arranging this for him, you know, was back and forth to me. First of all, you know, I needed to know how many were coming for dinner. And the number kept increasing, so that finally it was something like 15 or 16 that we had there at the house in Berkeley. Now,
it's a little annoying. I still had it on pause. Yeah. I think I have the gist of that. At the dinner, what were some of your recollections about the impressions of your guests that you had invited? Getting to hear Caesar and have a personal dinner conversation with him.
No, I'm not sure what your question is.
Well, you had handpicked about 15 or 16 people to come to dinner.
After dinner.
Oh, after dinner, to hear
not,
him
not
speak.
With dinner.
Okay.
No, after dinner. No.
And this was at your home that they were hearing him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you have any recollections about?
About their reaction to him? Well, he's a very moving person. He's a very moving speaker, and his commitment comes through so strongly, and I think that's catching. And I think that his value is in the person-to-person contacts that he makes, because I don't think anybody who's talked to him or heard him directly, you know, is unmoved by him.
You were impressed,
huh? Yeah. I think they all were, and I think that we, you know, we lined up a lot of additional support for him that night.
Mm-hmm. Are there? Do you feel that your experiences over the years with the farm workers movement, and in particular people, Caesar and others, changed your thinking in any way, or did it simply confirm your social and religious point of view?
Well, it made me more aware of the importance of the ecumenical movement in religion. And it certainly made me more aware of the importance of personal commitment in terms of life activity. I think it strengthened my feeling about the importance of a nonviolent reaction to social justice and to world events. So it was a very positive experience. To be honest, Pat, I'm not too aware of what the problems were after. See, the last affair I attended was the time that Caesar spoke on his trip to the Philippines. And I had already retired, and that was sort of an extra thing. And I'm not clear as to what's happened since. I'm going into that. But our activity, I think both Rosemary and mine, changed after I retired from the farm workers. There was kind of a little banner given to me by the Texas or Florida farm workers, I guess it was, and as a retirement thing. I think Chris arranged that.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, I think our activity has been more on. Especially Rosemary's, because I hadn't been too well the last couple of years, has been on a global level, particularly in the peace movement. And so while we had relationships, our lifestyle has been to take something on for a number of years and then change to something else that's also related, but not necessarily the same way. And Rosemary is now the director. Well, you want to speak for yourself what you're doing.
Well, it's called continuing peace dialogue. We're just trying to create one-to-one, face-to-face
contact between people around the world. Particularly, I've been working with the Soviet women to get women in the two superpower countries, the two adversary countries, together to try to, build some friendship and trust and. You know, between people at a grassroots level, kind of grassroots diplomacy.
Let's call it continue the dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Continuing the peace dialogue. Yeah, because the dialogue begins from the moment that you tell somebody you're going to the Soviet Union. And your family said, what? And, you know, and it's dialogue is over there with the Soviets, and then when you get back home and try to tell people what your experience was, there's a lot of dialogue. Mm-hmm. So we just call it continuing the peace dialogue.
What I'm saying and is that our focus has not been so primarily on the farm workers.
Yes, I understand.
In an active way. It's been a supportive way.
Yeah.
But there's another aspect of Rosemary. She just returned from Kenya, where she was,
well,
like,
was instrumental in taking about 100 women to the United Nations end of decade conference for women.
Yeah.
Her other aspect is the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rosemary is very much involved with that.
Well, the one other thing about Chris is that I always found him very receptive to my talking to him about the women in the farm worker movement and the role that the women farm workers played, you know. And I still felt that the UFW was a pretty male-oriented, male-dominated group, but that the women, you know, worked like mad right along with the men, you know, and needed more credit than they were getting. And I always found Chris very receptive to my discussions with him on that.
He encouraged me in the articles that I wrote.
One of the, what was the National Farm Worker Ministry newsletter, I think it was while Chris was still with it, devoting a whole issue, which you probably had a lot to do with, a whole issue on women in the farm worker movement, and that really got to me because, of course, I took some of the credit for his listening to me because I was always hammering away at it, and I was excited at the in 1980 at the Copenhagen Mid-Decade Conference for Women, the United Nations Mid-Decade Conference, which I attended, that Dolores was supposed to have been there and been on a panel on migrant women, refugee women, and I looked for her and she wasn't there. And when they introduced the person, it was her younger sister, I think it was, that was there. I think that's who it was. And I talked to her afterwards a little bit, and she said Dolores just couldn't get away, so she sent a substitute.
Mm-hmm.
But I was delighted then in 80 to think that the farm workers were reaching out and being involved in a global way, because I think it's only when any minority group, you know, finds out that there are others in the world that have the same common problems that they can really get together and make more progress in attaining their goals.
I'm reminded when you're talking two things, just a comment on that.
One is part of my work as the Rio Micro Ministry in California and in Arizona was what I would call educational. Some people call lobbying. And a great deal of time was spent in Sacramento at the time of the creation of the Agriculture Labor Relations Board, the decisions on that. Dolores and I worked together a great deal. I would make my clergy entrance, and the Lord should be in my coattails and surprise the representative.
Mm-hmm.
So, also in Arizona, I spent quite a time in Arizona at the time of Caesar's Fast, and that also involved a good deal of organizational work in that capacity. Part of my job was educational. Again, it involved petitions in front of stores and supermarkets and so forth as to...
On the recall.
I remember Howard and I also calling on one of the grape growers. Who was that? Mr. Anderson that we talked to in his office one day.
Well, it's the third largest distributor in California.
Wine distributor?
Yeah, I forgot.
Yeah, but we're during the grape strike.
Mm-hmm. And he indicated he was very sympathetic to the minority group because he was 132nd, 32 part of his Cherokee.
The thing that when you asked Howard what the question a few minutes ago reminded me of a letter that he has from Caesar, which it was in appreciation at one time. I don't remember what prompted it. Well, maybe it's when you got the Holmes Weatherly Award that Caesar wrote a letter about that.
Yeah.
The denomination award for someone who did outstanding work in social
Would
concerns.
You spell it for me?
Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S,
mm-hmm.
Weatherly. Those are two men.
L-E-Y?
Weatherly.
Uh-huh. E-Y.
Uh-huh. Award. And that was for outstanding work in social concern. And Caesar wrote a letter to him, I think it was at that time, that commented on Howard's ability to, well, how do we put it, assist and not take over to try to tell anybody how to do anything, but to let them call the agenda, you know. And
that's rare in denominational leaders, as you know.
Yeah. And this was the same experience that Howard had, you know, going down to Selma and Montgomery and earlier, you know, the civil rights days, was that there were so many ministers that were with him that felt that they had the answers and they wanted to tell the blacks what they should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Howard had the ability to simply let them set the agenda and then to support them in whichever manner they wanted and needed.
Mm-hmm.
And Caesar picked up on that in the letter, and I think that's a very key part of Howard's contribution.
Well, I think one of the recipients of the Holmes Weatherly Award, that's before I got it, a couple of years before, was the United Farm Workers as a recommendation.
Oh, really?
And the reason for that was that recommendation submitted by me to the award committee as a possibility that could be considered along with many others.
If somewhere along the line these dates and all seem important to you, you could give us a list of what you need, or
okay.
We could dig it up. You know, it's really hard right now.
Is the cultural contribution we tried to make to the library of the United Farm Workers, and I think we gave the UFW the final accumulator, but largely from one person really. Was a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
I think he has a picture in a book called Harvest and the Sun or something like that. He accumulated about 100 tapes that he had taken of the farm worker movement, the sounds going on.
In the 60s.
And they were given to Caesar at La Paz by us.
Mm-hmm.
We also contributed about 100 photographs which he had taken of the developing farm worker scene over 6 years, and it's in La Paz. There are some additional photographs.
Yeah,
after we used it extensively to the farm workers, the two films, Cecil Puede and Barbie Boycott, is that the other
mm-hmm.
one? When we finished with them, we gave them. The machine that we used was the
mm-hmm.
MM
mm-hmm.
Machine here, which we purchased ourselves after the
mm-hmm.
termination of the program as far as we're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
You have something there.
Well, I don't know where.
Well, I thought you were going to talk with Pat about the possibility of photographs.
I am, but that's
okay,
not necessarily
the most important work in your ministry.
Well, Pat, I consider it the most important work in my ministry because the relationships established were so profound. And the commitment of the individuals I contacted was so important to me because I learned so much from that. But also because I think the influence of this movement is really worldwide. That the sense of community, the sense of the importance of what a few persons can do if they are committed, was just so inspirational. And also, it enabled me to be in situations I never could have been in otherwise, and to come to terms with myself, and come to terms with my principles, and
And the pastoral relationships, even though there were not too many Unitarian Universalist Vamakas, the pastoral relationships went beyond denominational lines and became sort of a person-to-person involvement, which gave breadth and vision to the whole function of the church, the whole function of religion, the whole function of an individual as a representative of that tradition. Cut.
If you push the button on the far right side.
This one?
Yeah.